Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Have you ever walked around your house and thought, these tennis shoes, this camera, this stroller, this printer could be so much better? My guests today argue that a tremendous amount of creativity and a lot of work on the items that really matter to us have not come from companies. They haven't come from the top down, but they've come from people who really didn't like products the way they were and became part of the user innovation revolution. And I'm joined first by Eric von Hippel, professor at MIT's Sloan School, and Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Delighted to be here.
So, Eric von Hippel, I know that you've been studying user innovation for a really long time. So first, before we get into some really interesting cases of it, tell people, what is user innovation?
Okay. So consumer innovation is a form of user innovation. User innovation is when people develop things to use it rather than to sell it. And it can be a firm making things for itself or consumers, as you say, making things for themselves. And historically, this has been something that has not been considered to be major or possible. But what recently we have done with colleagues is to do surveys, national representative surveys in the UK, US, and Japan, and found out it's absolutely huge. In fact, it challenges the scale of all the producer innovation done for consumers. So it's absolutely massive. It's the dark matter.
And we really think of things, I think, as coming from the top down. Is that Procter & Gamble says, well, here's our new, you know, toaster, or Gillette says, here's the new razor. And your argument is, wow, no, there's a lot of things that have come from the bottom up, and we just don't realize it.
Absolutely right. I mean, basically, consumers innovate, and they're behind many of the innovations that manufacturers like Procter & Gamble make, but consumers have no incentive to advertise. So basically what happens is Procter & Gamble sees that something has spread in the user community, then say, oh, I guess we'll make it. And then they say, buy our XYZ. And before you know it, everybody thinks, that they're the innovators.
Carlos Baldwin from Harvard Business School, how do big companies deal with the fact that so many people on the ground are fixing products and tinkering with them and trying to make them better?
Well, Kara, I think there's been a real sea change in the last decade and a half. And even though user innovation has been going on for a very long time, it became important really with the rise of cheap computing and cheap communication, which allowed users to band together and share their ideas and break up the work into modules and bring those modules together. And that happened first on a large scale in the software community with the phenomenon called open source. Originally, the companies were, I think, actively hostile to this new way of doing things. And we have Steve Ballmer of Microsoft saying Linux and open source code base under the GPL was a cancer.
And this is fear, it feels like,
fear.
Right? That people are creating things that are competing with his products.
And they sowed fear in reverse, fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the quality of these products, about did they infringe on various patents that Microsoft had. But at the same time, other companies began to see possibilities to tap the creativity of users to find people that had great ideas that they didn't know where they were, to figure out who was really good at design. And so forward-looking companies began to design strategies that used this new source, used the dark matter, and they would segregate their designs into those pieces that they would control and those pieces that the users would actively work on.
Eric von Hippel, let's talk about a couple of products that maybe everybody knows, but they do not realize that they came from users, from consumers themselves, not somebody in a corporate office somewhere who thought of it.
Sure. So a wonderful example and an entire area, really, is sports. Because all sports, effectively, all sporting equipment is entirely developed by users. And you see, you know, something that might be not familiar to many listeners, the very modern things like kite surfing and wingsuits. But if you look back at something like, for instance, mountain biking, the story is always the same in every sport. What happens is that the users start to do something, and the producers say, that's really stupid. That's not a market. Nobody would ever want to do that. And then it begins to spread amongst communities of users. They say, whoa, this is really good. I think I'll do that too, whether it's a skateboard or whatever. And then eventually manufacturers come in and they say, okay, I guess we'll make something like that. And then the cycle begins again. So like when you see, for instance, in mountain biking, what happened first was they rode down mountains. And so users made more robust bikes. Producers followed. And then the users started to jump. And when you jump, you need suspensions. They came down. They said, ouch, this really hurts. So the users made new suspensions. Manufacturers once again said, this is the stupidest thing we ever heard. Who the hell would ever do that? And then that became very popular. And then manufacturers introduced their versions of what the users had pioneered.
So mountain bikes originally didn't exist. It was people just putting thicker tires or whatever on their existing bikes and saying, I'm not going to use this on, you know, paved roads. I'm going to do whatever I'm going to go up to a mountain and take it down.
Yeah, well, what happened was they took their regular bikes that Dad gave them for Christmas up the Mount Tamalpais, as it turns out, rode them down to the bottom, and they were a piece of junk. So they couldn't return them, you know. So they actually built their own using motorcycle brakes and so on. So they actually built their own to be really sturdy. Yeah.
And I know something we see all over the place, the baby jogger.
Yeah, that's so cool.
You know, there was just a guy. I think he was actually a journalist, right? He just came up with the baby jogger. Talk about how that happened.
Well, the story goes that it was Phil Batchelor, I think was his name. And his wife, as I understand it, said, stroll the baby. And he said, I want to jog. She said, stroll the baby or die. And he said, well, okay, you convinced me. And in that case, then there's a picture of him actually in his garage and taking the wheels off his other kids' bikes. I assume the kids were old enough so they didn't need those bikes anymore, and building the baby jogger. And then he ran around the streets with this thing. And everybody who saw him said, man, I want one of those too, which is very interesting because Sonali Shah, a colleague of ours, has recently in a Kaufman study showed that 50%, 46.6 actually, percent of ventures founded on new innovations are founded by users. So it's not only that the users innovate and spread them for free, which they certainly do. Many of the things that governments love to tax, new companies, are also formed by users. And in Phil Batchelor's case, again, it was he was running around. Everybody said, whoa, this is really great. I want one too. He said, fine, I'll start a company. And so that's how that started.
Let's talk a little bit about how long this has been around, this idea of things coming from really smart people out there, but not necessarily the people who are at the top of organizations. A few months ago, I talked to Karim Lakhani from Harvard Business School, and he pointed out that crowdsourcing is nothing new.
I'm going to take us back to the Renaissance. So this notion that we can actually get anybody in the world to solve our problems has been actually practiced quite a bit in the Renaissance period when governments wanted to get problems solved. So, for instance, the dome in Florence at the cathedral came about because they wanted to run a contest around the best design for the dome, and the dome had to be unsupported. All the architects at the time said, this can't be done. So the tower stood open for 50 years. They ran a contest, and then Brunelleschi came about, who's a goldsmith with the design. And so this notion was that we as organizations may not have all the best people working for us for a particular problem. And the best thing for us to do is to actually let anybody in the world participate and create a solution for us.
So Carlos Baldwin from Harvard Business School, this is really, in a lot of senses, a very old idea that's been around for a long time, that the smartest people may not necessarily be the people in the positions of power.
Mm-hmm. And this idea was put into modern form by Bill Joy, a founder of Sun Microsystem, who said, not all smart people work for you, and you must take that into account in devising your strategy. I think, although the phenomena has been around a long time, the reach of it has vastly expanded. And so at this point, companies really can't afford not to look out there, but they face problems. They don't know where people are who might have good ideas. They don't know whether they're any good at what they do. And people have different motivations. Not all people want to work for an existing manufacturer. So these crowdsourcing techniques and tournaments are good at getting people to self-identify. You get to evaluate their quality after the fact. And it brings in people whose motivation isn't necessarily to work for a big company.
And we're joined by Benjamin Mako Hill, PhD candidate at MIT and a user innovator, one of those smart people out there working on things. So I wonder, do you see, I know you've worked in some sense on Canon cameras, on open source software. Do you see a user innovation revolution going on?
Absolutely. I think that when you look at open source more generally, you just see really hundreds of thousands of examples of projects of users either sort of solving their own problems and offering them out to people, or very often working together and collaborating towards the production of really incredible examples of sort of platforms for innovation as well.
So talk a little bit about the stuff that you've done with Canon, why people wanted in the first place to try to change what the cameras could do.
Yeah, so there's this there's a great example of a project called CHDK. It stands for the Canon Hackers Development Kit, or Dev Kit. And what it is a way to modify the firmware that runs on Canon cameras. And very originally, it was actually born out of frustration by users of Canon cameras who were frustrated by some of the sort of market segmentation strategies. That is sort of Canon's plan to make a whole bunch of different types of cameras and sort of charge people more for certain ones and to include certain features in some and not others. A feature that a lot of users wanted was what's called shooting raw photographs. And it's raw is basically just raw sensor data. On cheap cameras, the raw sensor data is just thrown away after the compressed image is made. And a number of users who wanted the ability to have this raw sensor data so they could do a lot of sort of darkroom style effects were able to sort of basically hack their cameras. They were able to modify the firmware such that they could do this. And when they shared that change on online forums and communities, what happened was is a broad interest of other sort of photography enthusiasts who had Canon cameras and who were, for example, using that piece of software or that modification on their cameras, were interested in building a new functionality, sort of got together and kept adding to it.
And it really allows people to take different kinds of pictures from what they might normally take.
That's right. So what started out is just a basic sort of, you know, attempt to shoot these sort of darkroom style negatives with digital cameras sort of ended up with this community of people who are doing lightning photography. So people who are doing ultra high speed photography, now sort of three times faster than the fastest commercially available digital cameras previously on $50 point and shoots, all kinds of interesting features. I mean, like the ability to shoot these high dynamic range photos, just tons and tons of stuff. A paper will come out in a sort of scientific photography journal, and within a day, it will be supported using the CHDK platform. Mm. So all kinds of crazy innovation, including things that not only things that the sort of camera companies hadn't thought of, but even things that the camera companies had previously thought was impossible, like physically impossible on their cameras.
And Eric von Hippel, I can see you want to get in here.
Yeah, I want to say one thing more generally, which is that we've said so far that consumer innovation is huge, it's really important, but it's also a good thing. I mean, that's what we have to understand. Despite the resistance of companies, many companies, they're adapting, it's a good thing. Users get to make exactly what they want for themselves. They're empowered. They don't have to buy and adapt whatever the company sells them. That's one thing. But another thing is it's better for social welfare. And the reason for that is that when a user innovates, a user typically gives it away. And the reason the user gives it away is because they are benefiting from use value. They don't have to benefit from selling it. If I make a mountain bike and I use it, that's what I did it for. Now, the result of that is that from producers' point of view, number one, we have a new partitioning of the innovation process where the producer really can let the user innovate and produce some of the things. That's to the benefit of the producer. But at the same time, the fact that it's free, that users can make their own copies, puts a price discipline on the producer. That's good for social welfare. Then the next final piece is that basically things like mountain bikes would not exist if there weren't things to do with them. That's called a complement. All the techniques don't go through manufacturers at all. There's this giant parallel peer-to-peer teaching of how to ride a mountain bike. The only reason that manufacturers can get monies on mountain bikes is because those techniques exist. So in a way, the producers are taking some of the innovations that users develop and selling them, but they could not exist without complementary user innovations.
We're talking about creativity springing up from you, the consumer, rather than trickling down from the corporate suites of companies. Are we witnessing a user innovation revolution? And what would that mean for all the products that we buy? Well, let me go back for a second to Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School. This is a real change for companies. Talk about a company that did not deal well with people trying to take their products and improve upon them.
Well, Sony. Sony makes a little dog, a robot dog called the Aibo. And as with the Canon camera, as soon as it came out, people wanted to teach the dog to do new tricks that weren't in the Sony software that the dog was pre-programmed with. So they created a community and began to post their ideas and solutions to a website, and Sony sent a cease and desist order to the owner of the website, basically using the DMCA, which is a pretty hefty legal threat, to say, you can't do this. Not really a very friendly thing to do.
And whatever happened to the little robotic Sony dog?
Actually, there was a lot of user pushback and a bit of a firestorm. And now Sony reluctantly made parts of its code open, publishes a software developer kit, but for non-commercial use only. So they've been brought kicking and screaming into the modern age.
Mako Hill, Carlos mentioned earlier about Steve Ballmer saying that open source was fundamentally bad, a sort of cancer. And I know that you've been working on open source software since you were 11 or 12. Isn't open source a pretty big threat to a behemoth like Microsoft that wants to sell you their operating system for your computer?
It's, on some level, it is a threat to Microsoft. At least it's a threat to the way in which Microsoft has done business in the past. At the moment, Microsoft has sort of changed their mind a little bit. They're actually contributing a lot to the Linux kernel and to a bunch of other projects. It is a threat to the way in which they've built software in the past, which is to say, we do it internally. We have our sort of expert engineers build this thing, and then we sort of give it to you, and you just sort of use it. But I think that it's certainly not a threat that is concerns most of the people doing this, right? When I have a piece of software that doesn't work, I want to fix the bug, right? And I think that most people who sort of are so concerned with the fact that their software doesn't work, they just want to fix it. And if that happens to sort of lead to a complicated business decision for some firm out in Seattle, I think that
So, you talked about sort of hacking Canon cameras to make them do more exciting things, take pictures of lightning, pictures at high speeds, do all these things that Canon didn't really mean for them to do necessarily. How did Canon deal with that?
So it's interesting. The short version is that Canon hasn't responded. And even when the New York Times did a little story about CHDK a few years ago, and Canon sort of tries to say as little as possible. They say things like installing software on your camera could damage the device. No one's come forward and said it ever has, but it's, of course, a sort of possibility. I mean, the short version is the Canon doesn't really know what to do. And this has come out from Canon knows what's going on. They're monitoring what's going on in this community. And actually, a number of innovations which have come out first in CHDK or in within that community have sort of shown up in Canon cameras later.
They're learning a little bit from what's happening, but they haven't sent out like cease and desist because there are times, Carlos was taking at Sony and the little robot. They're not saying just stop what you're doing.
I think Canon has mixed feelings. On the one hand, CHDK only works for Canon cameras. It won't work on an Nikon camera. It's good. It's selling cameras. And it's a great source of innovation. On the other hand, it is sort of attacking some part of their business strategy, which is that you can buy the cheapest camera and load on CHDK and get basically all of the features in all the more expensive cameras. It won't make you have a better lens or a better sensor, which is part of something that they can encourage people to buy more expensive cameras. But they have sort of have mixed feelings about it. And as a result, their position, and I don't know, part of this is sort of their corporate culture, and part of this is just sort of their confusion with the situation is just to sort of be quiet.
So we've talked a little bit about the threat that this posed to big companies, but I also wonder what kind of opportunity it poses. And actually, last week we had the senior vice president of Under Armour, which a lot of people know, big sporting company, their innovation lab. And he talked about that they really try to have this sort of open approach to innovation and to let consumers contribute ideas. Let's listen to what Kevin Haley, the senior vice president of Under Armour's innovation lab, had to say.
We want and encourage outside inventors, companies, really universities, anyone to bring us the greatest ideas out there, and then we will bring them to the consumer. We had compression short with this very elastic base material, but then a very strong, almost elastic band that crisscrosses in an X over the pelvis and around the back and over the hips. And it just holds the core together in a way that is something you really have to experience to understand. But we saw it popping up in NHL locker rooms and on some college football teams, you know, one here, one there. And the gentleman who was running it came to us and said effectively, I've been working on this for 20 years. It's a fantastic product. I have no distribution. I have no marketing. I have no brand. He was struggling to sell many units at a $30 price point. And so we actually got involved and made it a little more commercial just in terms of comfort and appearance, but using his overall concept. And the great thing about it is that when push came to shove at the end, the product was no longer covered by his patents, but we really said, you know what? We're going to pay you the royalty anyhow because we want to encourage people to bring us these great ideas.
Carlos Baldwin from Harvard Business School. There is that sort of school of thought of you really should open up because there are some – I mean, I think it's interesting here that he said, well, we saw it popping up in professional sports locker rooms here and there, and then we thought maybe there's something to this. Yeah.
So this is really, I think, where companies need to go in today's age, to embrace this new phenomenon, this newly powerful surge of creativity. But it's very important. He said he didn't take the innovation from the original inventor, which, talking about ethics, has been a pattern in the past. And he said, we didn't do it because we want to continue the reciprocal benefit of the innovators innovate, come to us as their executor, and know they'll be treated fairly. And I think that's a very, very important lesson here, that just grabbing the IP, the intellectual property, isn't the best way to go.
And have you seen that where big companies sort of swoop in and sort of bigfoot an idea and say, thank you very much, we'll take that and not give you any money for it necessarily?
Yeah. It's been going on for hundreds of years.
Really, yeah.
And, you know, innovators sue over this. There was a windshield wiper suit, I think, but the mechanical reapers were taken from user innovation 100 years ago.
Eric von Hippel, have companies sort of realized that this community of user innovators can really help them?
Well, what companies have to realize, they're starting to, but what companies have to realize is that they're not going to get driven out of business by this. Innovation is a cost. And companies can still make money by economies of scale. Basically, remember what that Under Armour guy said. You know, he said, well, this guy has no distribution, no brand, whatever, right?
Right. We've got stores. We can put it in our stores, right?
Exactly right. So what's really happening here is that if companies get used to the idea that innovation is often done better outside by users who are closer to the need, and the next thing that happens is by the diffusion of those innovations, you can see which are the good ones. Like what he said was it popped up in NFL locker rooms, right? So in other words, people were finding it useful. It
right.
wasn't just a random idea.
Right.
Then the company comes in, they have a higher chance of success, and they have the advantage of distribution and brand and so on to make money. And then, as Carla says, they really have to understand how to work with these communities so the communities don't feel ripped off.
And are companies increasingly embracing this trend?
The initial reaction of firms is, no, we like to do things that we the way we've always done them. This is a threat. It's actually a huge opportunity. It's an opportunity for the firms and the fleeter-footed ones. This is a transition. This is a revolution, a paradigm shift. The fleeter firms will succeed, and the ones that continue to drag their feet, you know, will get outcompeted.
And we see it with Apple. Apple is basically like, here, we have a phone. You design our apps, right? And put it out there to the world.
Well, but the fascinating thing is that initially they resisted.
Oh,
right?
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the users jailbroke the phone. Mako can explain
yeah, that's right.
That. It was
in,
so cool.
I mean, in the early days before there was an app store, when you sort of got the phone and it did things that Apple wanted it to do, what you saw was that an enormous proportion of users, by some estimates, up to 25% of all people who bought an iPhone had basically basically attacked the security software on their phone, their own phones, the ones that they had purchased, so that they had so they could hack it, so that they could use it on different networks, so that they could install custom software. And only after there was this like enormously widespread sort of modification of devices did Apple sort of launch a sort of approved way in which user innovators could sort of build new applications and then share them with others.
It's had sort of gone on board with what was happening already.
And hugely fought it. I mean, they bricked your phone. Do you remember that phrase?
No.
Yeah, they managed to do things so that if you managed to design or to free up your phone, unlock it, jailbreak it, what they would try to do is, quote, brick it, namely turn it into a brick that was totally unfunctional. How's that for a response?
That's quite a response. Eric von Hippel, professor at MIT's Sloan School, Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School, and Benjamin Mako Hill, PhD candidate at MIT and a user innovator. This has been a great discussion. Thank you so much for coming in. And thank you for joining us this hour. Remember that we're online at wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can find more information about our guests and link to our iTunes podcasts. We'll be back next week with more big ideas. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.